Do you or someone you love wish you had a better job? Want to be happier on your current job? Don't even have a job? Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Whether you're a nonprofit fundraiser, or you work for a company and you're trying to get your idea implemented, or you work for a government agency trying to get the public to do this or that, you'll recognize that messaging matters. How to message brilliantly, maybe brilliantly enough for it to create word of mouth, even go viral. Wharton, that is the University of Pennsylvania, business marketing professor Jonah Berger has spent the last decade trying to figure all that out. And he's summarizing what he has learned in that new book. He's not just summarizing, he's actually summarized. The book's done, just came out. It's called Contagious. Jonah Berger, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
My pleasure. So you looked at messaging initiatives that have been successful, and you reviewed which New York Times articles were most often emailed, and you've identified six keys to good messaging. We'll get to those in a minute. But it's easy to look backward, be retrospective, and find commonalities about what worked, because we know they did work. But the question is, how predictive are those of what will work when you or I try to create the next initiative? I mean, if you take 100 new messaging initiatives, all of which incorporate your six keys, many, if not most of those initiatives would end up not getting sufficient people to buy the idea or the product, whatever. Do you have hypotheses as to what differentiates failed versus successful messaging beyond the six factors in the book?
Well, you know, the type of analysis you're talking about is actually just what we did, for example, in some of our research. So when we looked at the New York Times most emailed list, we didn't just look at articles that made the list. We also looked at failures, things that don't make the list, things that didn't get off the ground. And so what we can do there is we can say, well, what are characteristics that separate successes and failures? Looking over 7,000 articles, for example, we can say things like, look, you know, more anger-inducing articles are 33% more likely to be shared. More emotional articles are 20% more likely to be shared. Articles that have more useful content in them are 30% more likely to be shared. So we can predict the success of new content being likely to be highly shared based on these characteristics. It's not just looking at successes and sort of cherry-picking things that seem to work there. It's looking across thousands of different successes and failures and looking for commonalities.
Even so, you're still looking retrospectively. The ironclad, the gold standard test would be to take your six criteria, apply them to say a dozen or, you know, some random sample, a good sample size of new initiatives, and have six that met, you know, that divide the, let's say you have this, let's say one initiative. One of my favorite initiatives is a college report card. Mandating that every college, as a condition of receiving federal financial aid, be required to put a consumerist with teeth consumer report card, a college report card, on its homepage. So a study would be to take that initiative and have two approaches, one that incorporated all of your six keys, the other which does not but is otherwise sound, and see whether in fact virality is greater in those that use your six. Am I correct about that being where the research needs to go?
We've actually done things very much like that. So we can take large data sets and break them up into two samples. And we can use our predictions on the first half to see if we get significant predictors, and then see whether we can use those same predictors to drive success in the second half. So predicting things that we don't know how well they'll do, and we get the same results. So conceptually, we've done exactly what you talked about. Now, I agree with you. You can't guarantee that anything will be a success. You know, I'm not guaranteeing that you can follow this formula and get a million views or a billion views, but it's just like baseball. You don't hit a home run every time you go to bat in baseball, but there are tricks, techniques, sure, principles to increase your average.
Great.
And that's exactly what we're doing here. We're showing people how to become better hitters to get their messages talked about and shared.
Okay, so before we get back to those six things, though, let's again, let us be prospective. Let us take Jonah Berger. Jonah Berger is a rising star at Penn. He's an assistant professor. Desperate, I'm sure you want tenure. And I'm sure that you, in your efforts to get tenure, are trying to use various strategies, messaging and otherwise, to maximize the chances, to increase your the probability of you getting tenure. As a way of introducing our listeners to your six keys in the book, Contagious, what are some of those six strategies you are using as we speak to try to maximize your chances of getting tenure?
Well, Marty, you'll be happy to know I actually just did get tenure. So
congratulations.
That
wonderful. So what did you do?
Let me talk about what we did for the book, because I think that's a great example. So I had a new book. No one had heard of it before I wrote it. How can we get that book to catch on? So you're in the bookstore, you're on the subway, you're at work. There are hundreds of books that other people are reading. How do you increase the chance that this one pops? Mm-hmm. So we took one thing that we've learned in our research, the concept of public, the idea that the more easy it is to see what others are doing, the more likely it is that people imitate them. And we use that to design the cover of the book. If you walk into your local bookstore or look online, the cover of Contagious is not a normal cover. It's a bright electric orange cover. It's so colorful. In fact, it's actually hard to just print off the web and get that color to work. We had to do some special things to get the color to pop. But what it means is that anytime you see someone reading this book, you're much more likely to notice it. If you walk onto, people have posted on Twitter, for example, photos of other people reading the book on the subway. It's just like Livestrong wristbands. Easy to see, even from far away, making it more likely that you'll look at it and you'll want to find out more.
That's why the Dummies books use an absolutely iridescent yellow as the pop color. But I happen to notice, in part of doing my research on this show, I noticed that you actually printed books, or at least images of your book cover, in a number of different colors, many of which were not bright. What drove you to do that?
So we tried some different ones. We actually did testing. We did some market research to say, okay, well, what would the right color be? How might this color affect different people's behavior? We knew we wanted a bright color, but is it bright blue, bright orange, bright yellow, for example? So we did a bunch of market research. We tested these different messages, and we used the feedback we received to roll out the final one.
So orange, is orange a generalizable truth that when in doubt, use iridescent pop-out orange?
So orange is a very active color. It depends on what you want. So if this book was actually a book on relaxation, I would not have made it. orange makes you want to take an action. It just like spreading is an action, passing something on is an action. Orange is a very active, fired up color. We also thought about yellow, but while we liked blue a lot, and that was the second color, blue is a much more relaxing color,
right.
Calming color. And that's very good for certain things, but not good for others.
I mean, this has nothing to do with anything. It's just a personal curiosity. I was on the faculty at Berkeley, and I had the privilege of having the cover story in Family Circle, and it was called How to Make Sure This Is Your Child's Best School Year Yet. And I brought in a faculty meeting, and I'm proudly showing it, and they laughed at me. Why would you want to publish in Family Circle? But so here you are. You've got this pop psych standard, this book that's really mainstream trade publication, marketed with the right colors and everything. How come you're saying that it helped you get tenure? How is it helped you get tenure where, doesn't academia look down on trade publications?
So I can't say that this book actually helped. I've published over 2 dozen academic papers,
right.
And I think that tenure is really based on the academic contribution you make. But as a researcher myself, and you may be familiar with this as well, academic research is great, but you also want to make sure that it's used, that people actually find out about mm-hmm. these things. Because if you spend a long time working on a project, you learn some great things, as we have, about why messages are shared, why content goes viral, how social influence works. It's much more gratifying if you can get that information out there and help people.
Right.
There's so much misinformation out there at the moment about why things go viral. If you look around on the web, there's so many social media gurus that supposedly have the answer, but have never actually looked at any data. They're just making educated guesses. They don't have any science backing them up. And so what I thought was useful here is we had the science. Definitely there's more work to be done, but we had some very interesting science, and I wanted to share that with the world and help people to make their own, whether it's a product, an idea, a small business, help those things catch on.
So let's head back to that question of how you got tenure, but let's pivot. You're saying it wasn't the book, but it was the journal articles, but as you correctly point out, just publishing them and read by the 12 people who also read the Journal of Obscure Business, marketing, isn't going to give you enough pop even among academics. So as an organic way to try to elucidate your six principles for our audience. Which of those did you use in helping your journal articles to have sufficient pop as to increase your chances of getting tenure?
Well, I don't think this is about increasing the chance of getting tenure, but I think it is increasing the chance of the ideas diffusing. How do you craft your own message around, let's say, a scientific contribution to increase the chance that people want to talk about it in Syria? Mm-hmm. And so one thing I talk about in the book is social currency. People like to talk about things that make them look good.
Right.
That's why, just like we buy certain cars or certain clothes,
right,
what we say affects how people see us.
Right.
So crafting messages around research that makes it seem remarkable is going to make people want to talk about it and share it. We don't just want to talk about, we do talk about some mundane things, but the more remarkable something seems, the more we're going to be activated and want to pass that thing on. And so figuring out not only what are the right research questions to ask, but how can we frame research questions in ways that make them more exciting, more interesting, and more remarkable to the general population.
Something that's I've noticed that I have a hypothesis about what really motivates people, which is if you make, as you said, if you make them feel good about themselves, that's why people buy a Mercedes, even though it breaks down more often than a Toyota, somehow they feel better about it. Society is a brand name oriented, designer label oriented. But when you come up with a remarkable idea, it tends to, among many people, make them feel less than. Oh, how come he came up with that and I didn't? So this notion of social currency and getting them to feel good about themselves is really being a remarkable idea, something that makes people feel good. What in that social currency? I want to drill down into that, because I think that's a critical issue for engendering word of mouth. What did you do with those journal articles that you did to try to make, to really maximize the social currency?
Well, I think I'll give you a story instead of talking about journal articles, because I think that might be more interesting to your broader audience. But think about what LinkedIn did about a month ago. So they sent out an email to a number of their subscribers saying, hey, your profile is one of the top 10%, top 5%, top 1% of profiles in terms of how much they're viewed or how many friends you have or whatever that is. Now, many people thought that was interesting, but many people also passed that information on. They shared it with their friends. They shared it with their colleagues at work. They shared it with their followers. Why did they share it? Well, they shared it because it made them look good. Having one of the top 10% of profiles, the top 5% of profiles, having that status makes people look good, so they want to share it with others. But notice along the way that LinkedIn gets to come for the ride. Even though you're talking about how great you are because you got this award, this recognition, you have to say who gave it to you. I have one of the top 10% of profiles on LinkedIn. And so along the way, LinkedIn gets to be part of the discussion. By helping other people look good, LinkedIn gets their message out there. And so that's one key idea. You see the same thing with frequent flyer miles and other sorts of programs. Whenever you make someone feel good about themselves, whenever you let them spread the word about themselves because they're looking good, if you're part of that message, they'll pass it on. And so by enabling other people to look good, you can spread word of mouth about yourself.
You're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is Jonah Berger, a Wharton professor who has written a brand new book called Contagious. It basically presents six factors, six things to consider as you try to improve your messaging, whether it be for a product or an idea simply that you want to promulgate in your organization. I want to take that back. I'm very interested in the social currency thing, because I think that that is at the hub of what makes things go viral. I like the term virality. Take my idea of the college report card, requiring colleges to have to put a consumer-oriented report card on how much value added in terms of writing, critical thinking skills accrues between freshman and senior year, what is the actual true cost of attendance, discounting financial aid, the true four-year graduation rate, the employability, the employment statistics for broken down by major. Everybody I've ever spoken to said that's a slam dunk. It's obvious. It's a Consumer Reports kind of thing. They should, with the billions of dollars that colleges get in Pell Grants and loans and all the stuff from the taxpayer, they should at least be required to have as much accountability as we require of a tire that has the tread life, et cetera, molded into its sidewall. How could I incorporate social currency as a principle to try to engender virality for that concept?
I mean, I think the first question with that concept, is it easy enough for people to understand? Because one problem is that you don't only want to create a message that you can spread, that when you say it, people will hear you, but they can easily spread. And if the message is too complicated, if it's too complex, they're not going to be able to pass it on. So I really like that idea, as you just suggested, for example, of consumer reports for colleges.
Right.
Or a college, calling it a college report card. But I think the one problem is when you say college report card, I don't know exactly what that refers to.
Mm-hmm.
What about a college do we have on the report card? And when you say consumer reports for colleges, I think people would say, oh, that's great. But wait, isn't that what U.S. News and World Report does? Isn't that their top college list? And you would say, no, not at all, actually. There's really important information that they're not incorporating.
Right.
But I think you need to come up with an analogy or a way of simplifying that message to focus on a comparison so people get the key details.
Good point.
So I had a student in my course who was working on actually a college-related project himself. He was interested in building something that would help advisors, high school advisors, help students for colleges. The notion is, applying for college is a really complicated process. There's so many different things, so much information. You need to simplify the process. And so he used an analogy saying, you know, my company is like an easy pass for the college application process.
Right.
And when you hear that, you go, you don't know exactly what they do, but you get a good idea of what they do very quickly. You get a good sense of what it does because it compared it to something we all know.
Exactly.
And so I think that comparison is key. Making it, and I think Consumer Reports is a good place to start, making a comparison that allows people to understand what that message is.
Okay, dear listeners, there's a good takeaway. I want you, embedded in what he just said was the criticality of putting yourself in the shoes of your audience. What would make them be able to, in a sentence, say it? I mean, I know in the world of screenwriting and in films, they always have to, you have to have a one sentence soundbite. You know, it's like gorilla meets same time next year, Godzilla meets same time next year. Some phrase that can easily be transmitted is funny or smart or is immediately obvious. It's a great point, and is thank you very much for that, Jonah Berger. Let's move to different, less academic examples, but stay within social currency for another moment. You give a couple of examples that are particularly seductive about the use of social currency. One is the use of a secret exclusive club that you enter in the back door of a hot dog restaurant. Another is the $100 cheesesteak. Pick a story, any story, to otherwise illustrate the social currency concept.
I think Please Don't Tell is a great example. So imagine you're in New York City. You're walking around the Lower East Side one day, and you decide you need a bite to eat. So you notice there's a hot dog restaurant that has a big hot dog-shaped sign. You go check it out. You walk down. They have every hot dog you can imagine. You know, a good morning hot dog with bacon, eggs, and cheese. A hot dog with green onion and pineapple. Anything you could want. They've got it. Great selection. So you pick your hot dog. You're sitting there munching on it. When you notice, in the side of the wall is actually a phone booth, an old school phone booth, one of those numbers that, you know, Clark Kent would jump into to change into Superman. So just for kicks, walk in that phone booth. It's a little cramped. Slide open the door, walk inside, and you'll notice a rotary dial phone on the wall. And if you actually dial any number on that rotary dial phone, just go in your finger in a circle, you'll pick up the other line, and someone will ask you if you have a reservation. You say, a reservation? I'm in a phone booth inside of a hot dog restaurant. What would I have a reservation for? But if they can take you or you have a reservation, the back of that phone booth will open and you'll be led into a secret bar called Please Don't Tell. Now, Please Don't Tell has violated a lot of traditional laws of marketing. There's no sign on the street, no sign inside the restaurant. They've done everything they can to make it hard to get into. Yet every day they're full. They've never advertised. They've never spent a dollar on advertising, yet they're full. There's so many people call in. The phone line is always busy. By 3:30 p.m., phone lines open at 3. By 3:30, all the seats are gone. How did they do it? Well, it's interesting. If you think about it, they did a lot to make themselves a secret. And you could say, well, what's good about that? Well, think about the last time someone told you a secret. They told you not to tell another soul. Think about what you did next. When someone tells you not to tell a secret, you're going to tell someone else because the fact that it's a secret makes the information seem better and makes you look good for having it in. And so that's what Please Don't Tell did. They harnessed this idea of social currency by making people feel special, like they have access to things that not everyone else has access to, like they're smart, like they're in the know. By making them feel like insiders, they got people to spread the word.
I love it. So is there another example of making people feel special that has utility? This show focuses on work and the workplace. Can you give me another example of making someone feel special that will make them, one of them, promulgate the idea or use the idea?
Well, so it, just a workplace example, I'll give you a case of where we had discrete sales outcome at the end, which always helps. So are you familiar with BlendTex, Will It Blend?
Oh, my God, yes.
Yeah. So this is one of those things people often hear me talk about those ideas, and they say, oh, Professor Berger, these are great, but they won't work for me. You know, sure, hidden bars are lots of fun, or, you know, sure, if you have a lot of money or you have a really exciting idea, but I've got a really mundane idea. I've got a boring idea. I sell cement. I do logistics management software. I'm in a temp agency for accountants. Who's going to talk about a temp agency for accountants? And what I always say with that is it's not just about certain products being born remarkable. Certain things just naturally get word of mouth and others don't. It's about finding the inner remarkability behind any product, figuring out what makes something remarkable and getting people to talk about it or share it. And so Will It Blend is a great example of this. It's a blender company that's called BlendTech. They make blenders. No one wants to talk about blenders. Blenders are one of the most boring, mundane products out there. But they put together these series of clips online that show them blending things. So my favorite, they drop an iPhone in a blender.
Right.
And you'd say, well, what are you going to do with an iPhone in a blender? There's no way the blender can cut through an iPhone. The CEO hits the smoothie button, and you watch this iPhone get torn to shreds. Glass, dust, all of it just down to nothing, except one scrap piece of metal and all the rest is dust. It's amazing. If you haven't watched this, I highly recommend it. You got to check it out. It got not thousands, not millions, but tens of millions of views. The set has over 100 million views. Sales went up 700% for a blender. And this is not the most remarkable product in the world, but what they did is they figured out why people share things, and they built on that. They figured out that people love sharing things that make them look good. Having entertaining content makes you look good. And so even though it's a blender, people will share it because it makes them look smarter than you know.
Also embedded in that is your earlier point about utter simplicity. Every average idiot can understand it. Every average idiot will find it funny. People love to laugh. And it's visual. Unlike some auditory thing, no matter what phrase, clever phrase I come up with, seeing an iPhone getting blended is visual and therefore more memorable and therefore more likely to get word-of-mouth virality. Make sense?
Oh, definitely. And one more piece is key here, right? The deal, the blender, is part of the narrative. People always talk about making viral content. They want people to share things. But at the end of the day, you want it to help you move the needle. And what's really neat here is you can't walk away from that video without realizing that that's a tough blender, which is exactly the message that BlendTech wants you to realize. You can't watch that video, an iPhone getting torn to dust, and not go, wow, that must be a really tough blender. And if I need a tough blender, this is good for me. And so I talk about in the book about crafting these Trojan horse stories, these narratives or vessels that have an outside shell, but inside, just like the Trojan horse, the brand of the benefit comes for the ride.
And you know, the punchline is this is not a blender like the $29 blender you're going to buy at Target. It's a $400 blender that competes with Vitamix. And by the way, Vitamix sue them for zillions of dollars for patent infringements, but I digress. Anyway, let's you are listening to Work with Marty Nemco. My guest is doing a great job. I really like what you're doing, Jonah. My special guest is Wharton Marketing Professor Jonah Berger. New book, Contagious, with 6 keys to good messaging. We have had a lot of fun with the first of those called social currency. Let's move to the second of them. The second of your 6 factors to getting people to buy your idea or your product. Again, this is not just about advertising. You could be working in a nonprofit trying to get your idea adopted by your organization or to get people to donate more money or a government agency, whatever. But the second of those 6 factors to getting people to buy your concept is triggers. Tell us about that.
So triggers, one example here that is helpful is Rebecca Black. We all remember her song a few years ago. It was called Friday. And many people ask, why did it hit, right? This song is terrible. Most people hate it. Yet it has over 300 million views. So something about that song is doing something right. Why did it have so many views? So we went and we looked at the data. And what you see is if you look for searches for the phrase Rebecca Black on YouTube, you'll see that they spike up. And then they go down, and then they spike up again, and then they go down, and then they spike up again, and so on and so on. But if you look closer, you'll notice that the spikes aren't random. There's actually some periodicity to them. Every 7 days is a spike. And you look closer, and you'll notice it every Friday.
Right.
That song is equally bad every day of the week. It's bad Monday, it's bad Tuesday, it's bad Wednesday, it's bad Thursday, and so on. But Friday provides a reminder in the environment, what psychologists would call a trigger, to make us think about, talk about, and share that song. It's just like if I said peanut butter and, everyone would think of the word jelly. because the two are connected in our mind. Peanut butter is like a little advertisement for jelly. It's a trigger, just like Friday is a trigger for Rebecca Black. And so even if your product or idea is not the most exciting or remarkable, it's about making sure people think about it, that it's triggered by the environment, that it comes to mind, and that it makes people talk about it and share it.
There is something else about that as well. It's got universality. Everybody on, you know, 90% of people are grateful for Friday. It's an emotional thing. It hits well on that. So I think the notion of trying to get to somebody's emotionality and universality is also key to what makes that work. And again, as we're looking for generalizable principles, dear listeners, think about what is a universally felt emotion or near universally felt emotion, and how you can, as you say, use a Trojan horse, something that ties into it, an outer shell that gets that would help you and your product or your idea tag along with that. Make sense?
Definitely.
Okay. Another example of that trigger thing, which, and again, with this Trojan horse, this connectivity thing, is the Kit Kat and coffee campaign. Again, nothing could be more mundane than stupid Kit Kat chocolate-covered wafers. Tell us about that story.
Everybody loves Kit Kat. It's one of my favorite types of candy. When I was a kid, I used to, if houses had Kit Kat, I would take one, I would walk away on Halloween, and I'd try to change my costume up so I could come back and get another one. But a few years ago, sales were down. Everybody loved Kit Kat, but they had forgotten about it. There were so many brands in the Hershey space that there wasn't just enough attention for all of them. So they tasked a brand manager. Her name was Colleen Chorak. They said, look, we don't have a lot of money. We'll give you a couple dollars for radio. You can come up with a campaign. If you can turn the brand around, we'll give you some more money. So she comes up with a very clever campaign called Kit Kat and Coffee. Basically, she says, look, you're having a coffee break? Have a Kit Kat. Think about coffee? Think about Kit Kat. She connects coffee with Kit Kat repeatedly again and again in their ads. And what's really good about that is it makes coffee a trigger for Kit Kat. Now, coffee is a good trigger for a number of reasons. You could eat the two of them together. You could dip your Kit Kat in coffee. There's even some alliteration there, and both around the idea of the break. Mm. But coffee is a perfect trigger for Kit Kat because it's so frequent in the environment.
Exactly.
People not only drink coffee once, they drink it frequently.
Yep.
It's a prevalent trigger.
Guilty as charged.
Yeah, it would be like Rebecca Black, instead of coming out with a song called Friday, came out with a song called Leap Day. Leap Day, Leap Day, you know, blah, 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 Leap Day. It might be catchy, but we only think about it once every few years.
Right.
Whereas Friday is once a week, every single week.
Love it.
The same thing, Michelob used to have an ad campaign called Weekends Are Made for Michelob. And the exact reason was they wanted us to think about the beer on the weekend. But it actually wasn't originally Weekends Are Made for Michelob. Originally, it was Holidays Are Made for Michelob. But they moved it to Weekends because they wanted us to think about it more frequently. Mm-hmm. And so when thinking about triggers, don't just use any trigger. Use one that's frequent or prevalent in the environment.
Makes sense. The third of your six factors in effective messaging is emotion, which we've obliquely addressed previously, but let's focus on it explicitly here. Particularly, and what I love about this in your book is not just emotion, but, and you mentioned this at the top of the show, the importance of creating high arousal messages, especially anger-inducing messages. And that's something, you know, the listenership here at KLW is a very social activist-oriented listenership, and so they are particularly likely to be able to invoke anger about, you know, the 99ers had its hub here in San Francisco, particularly among the listeners to KALW. Talk to me about messaging and emotion.
Messaging and emotion is an exciting area, but it's actually a little more complex than you might think. So you might think that people, as we talked about, share positive things to make them look good, but maybe they wouldn't want to share negative things to make them look bad. Why would we want to put others in a bad mood or attach ourselves to negative things? Yet, as you noted, if you notice, sometimes people share anger-inducing content, things that get them pissed off. So what is it about anger that drives people to share, and is it all emotions drive people to share? But when we looked closer, we noticed that it wasn't all emotions. Actually, some emotions increase sharing and some decrease sharing, but it wasn't about positive or negative. It was about, are those emotions activating or not? So if you think about anger, for example, versus sadness, anger fires us up. It makes us want to take an action. We want to throw something at the television, yell out loud, take some action, do something. Sadness makes us want to curl up in a ball and eat a bowl of ice cream and take a nap. Same thing with the positive side. There are certain positive emotions like excitement, like awe, like humor that fire us up. But other positive emotions like contentment They feel good, but they're not very activating. Mm-hmm. Imagine you come out of a yoga class or a massage or a long, warm shower. Mm-hmm. You feel good, but you don't want to do very much.
Right.
And so what our research shows is it's not just about positive and negative. It's about activating emotions.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about it, lots of angry content, op-eds get passed along, and lots of funny content on YouTube get passed along. Mm-hmm. Those might seem like two very different things, but they're actually really
Absolutely.
Similar.
Absolutely.
Both anger and amusement are high arousal emotions, and so they drive people to share.
The example that probably the single thing that, and it's embarrassing to admit it, but the single, I don't know, I guess YouTube video that was most activating for me, that I'm not one of those guys who does a lot of forwarding of stuff, but when I saw the Susan Boyle video of that most unprepossessing of people come out there, the least commercial, the least polished, she's the antithesis of the way the so heavily over-marketed performer. When she got up there and surprised her, because everybody expected her to be terrible, and then she was, the truth is, I'm a musician, she is very good. Is she great? No, she's not. But the surprise factor of the disparity between the preconception of what she was likely to be like and what she was so enormous that it pulled on the emotions to us. Can you tell us about how to prospectively, as we try to market our ideas, how can we engender that kind of emotional surprise? Any thoughts about that?
I think the key is to dig deeper. Often we think about the functional benefit of ideas or messages. We think about what's in it for the listener. What are they going to get? If it's a product, what features does it have? If it's a service, what benefits does it provide? But we need to focus less on function and more on feeling. Mm-hmm. We need to think about how is someone going to feel when they hear this message, mm-hmm. and how, if we want to get them to share, can we activate or create mm-hmm. activating emotions, get them fired up so that they want to take an action, so they're more likely to pass it on and engage in other actions. Often, researchers talk about this idea of digging in deeper and finding the three whys. Don't just say, well, why does someone do something? Wait for the answer. Ask yourself, why does someone do something? Why will someone, for example, with your college message, why would someone care about this? Mm-hmm. And then answer that question, then dig deeper. Why again? Why again? Why does someone use, to go back to an accounting temp service, why might someone use a service like that? Why might someone care about frozen yogurt? You answer, then you go, why again? Then you go, why again? And if you ask why a couple times, you can dig a lot deeper. You can find a deep core to that message that can get people to share.
I want to push on this. So let's make you, I'm making you work hard here, Jonah, I know, but it serves our listeners really well. So let's as you re-brought up my college report card example. Right. I want to figure out how to get people to be activating emotions. I love your term, activating emotions. How, if I had hired you as an expensive consultant to try to help, I know you would take weeks to figure it out, but we're on the radio. How would you go about trying to engender maximum activating emotion regarding this consumer reports, college report card that goes well beyond the crap in the U.S. news ratings?
Well, I think based on how you framed it so far, and you know a lot more about this than I do, but there's a lot of anger around colleges, mm-hmm. them being very expensive and them not necessarily mm-hmm. delivering on the key benefits mm-hmm. to students. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, maybe it's a factoid, right? Maybe it's that a huge percentage of tuition actually goes to something that has nothing to
right.
do with
shrubs.
Students.
Shrubs and administration, and sports facilities.
Maybe, right? Or maybe it's that actually, you know, the most expensive colleges don't turn out the best graduates. Maybe it's a fact that most, you know, whether it's a community college or for-profit colleges like Phoenix University, they don't actually end up providing bang for their buck. But finding one fact that's going to make people angry or one fact that's going to make them excited and building a case around that is key. Often I think, even as a writer, I found this myself, often we think, well, we just need lots of facts. We want to overwhelm people with data. But when we overwhelm people with data, they get overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
They're much less likely to take an action because they don't know where to go next. And so rather than overwhelming them, we want a simple emotional message.
Let me try one on you and see if this works. The Department of Education found that of students who graduated in the bottom 40% of their high school class and went on to a, quote, four-year college, 8 years later, only 24% graduated. So 3 out of 4, even if given 8 years, never graduated, having mountains of debt, unemployability an enormous time that could have been better spent preparing for a career in life. If I said that, and yet 200 that colleges recruit 200,000 of those students every year, especially students of color. It's like the Tuskegee experiments. Without disclosing those percentages, they put them through this expensive, long treatment. What feels right and wrong about that in terms of an appeal that would appeal to the emotion?
You know, I think that was just a great example of that. Each of those were good facts, but all together they get lost. Mm. And so rather than going so deeply into all of them, it's about finding one and building on that one piece of information.
Okay, let's move off that. Let's go to the fourth of your six keys to effective messaging. This is a little less obvious of what it means. The word is public. And we've addressed this kind of tangentially, but now let's explain what public as a key to effective messaging is.
Think about the last time you were trying to find a place to eat. You were trying to find a restaurant, maybe you were in a town you're unfamiliar with, or, you know, a city you've never been to before. And think about how you found a good restaurant. One way we often find restaurants is we look for a place that's full. We assume that, well, if lots of people are there, it must be good. And so the notion here is that we often look to others for information. Whether I'm trying to figure out, should I bring an umbrella to work, what's the appropriate way to dress for a given meeting, which salad fork is the right one to use, we look to others, we follow others. But the key here is we can only follow others if we can see what they're doing, if their behavior is public. And so one key aspect to getting products, ideas, and behaviors to catch on is to make them more public. The more people can see what others are doing, the more likely they will be to imitate it.
How do you so explain that? Give me an example of how, you know, it's one thing, you know, if I got a busy restaurant, I'm already there, but my problem is in kickstarting. If I've got this new idea or new product, I don't have devotees yet. Let's say, you know, I am an employee. I want to take it back to the workplace. I'm an employee and I want to get a new idea adopted. It does not have an active public. Obviously, I want to publicize it, but how do I cleverly, intelligently use your concept of public in order to get people, to get devotees?
So, I mean, think about something even small in the workplace, though. Like, maybe we're trying to get more people to recycle. Maybe, you know, we want more people, if we're a hospital, to wash their hands. Mm-hmm. Something very simple like that.
Okay.
Part of it, people have no idea what others are doing. You know, no idea. One of my favorite examples from the book is this initiative called Movember, which is wanted to raise money. Think about the problem with raising money. People have no idea what causes someone else donates to. In your office, for example, you may have no idea what your friend or coworker donates to. So how can you get that thing to catch on? Maybe you have a new cause you want your office mates to donate to. Well, one thing they figured out with Movember is they figured out a way to make the private public. This Movember campaign, they didn't only ask people to donate money to men's cancers, they actually had people grow mustaches as part of the initiative. So not only does someone sponsor you to raise money, but they sponsor you to grow a mustache for the month of November. And what that very cleverly does is rather than running a 5K or something like that, imagine someone comes into your office and now they have a mustache and they never had one before. You're going to ask them, well, wait, what's the mustache about? Why the change? Other workplaces have done this with a shoelaces initiative. They get people to wear colorful shoelaces to raise money for a particular cause. By figuring out a way to make that thing more private, even if it's one or two people, even if it's just you are wearing colorful shoelaces.
And even if we don't go that sexy, we could simply put a whiteboard up, let's say, you know, counting the, you know, sign up if you have donated to X, and then making public all the donations. Look, every charity, you know, I like theater. I've been involved in theater a lot. And, it, you know, every theater company has a list of all the donors. It makes it all public. So whatever your initiative, whether it be a charity initiative or whatever, if you make it very public and a sign up thing where, you know, is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Well, think about the key difference, though, between a list of donors versus the mustache example. A list of donors is public. It's out there, but someone has to look for it. Mm-hmm. What you want to do is turn any person who's a customer or supporter into an advocate by merely looking. So another example here is Apple with their white headphones. So remember when we all had portable CD players, MP3 players come out. We don't know which player to use, which is the good one. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, if we see a few people with white headphones, we go, wow, that must be pretty good. And so it's not Apple on their website having some data about how many people have used it. It's about every time someone is using the product, supporting your idea, engaging your initiative, it's easy for other people to see them doing it. Someone is doing something, whether it's listening to a type of music player, whether it's donating money, or even whether it's voting. Notice I voted stickers. they do a great job of making the private public.
Right.
Now it's easier to see who voted, and it increases the chance that other people vote as well.
Isn't that implicit in every bit of, you know, when I grew up, most clothing did not have the name in very large print. Now, every company wants to, you know, Abercrombie & Fitch or whatever, you know, Aeropostale in like 84-point font, you know, all over. Isn't that part of making the private public? It's like having everybody be a walking billboard for their jeans or whatever?
That's a little bit of it. But notice, as you just said, not everyone wants to be a walking billboard. Not everyone wants to be out there with a huge logo. And so there are other ways to do it. Apple didn't have to make their logo bigger. They just use unique color.
Right.
Movember didn't have everybody plaster Movember logos everywhere. They just had people grow mustaches. Even think about, you know, if you're in the workplace, you can print flyers out in a certain color of paper. And if everyone has one up on their desk and it's a certain color, people can easily see it. Imagine colored staplers. Imagine other visible signals, even sounds. Microsoft Office does a great job with their sound when you start up the computer. Everyone knows when someone else is using their software. And so whether colors, sounds, or smells, it's about making the private more public.
All right. Let's go to the fifth of your principle. By the way, I'm talking to Jonah Berger. He is a Wharton professor who's written a good new book called Contagious, which identifies six. And this is not off top of head. He's got he spent some good years collecting data to identify some factors that seem to be key to building word of mouth virality, basically getting your message done. We've been going through these one at a time. I'm having fun doing it. Hopefully, you're having fun listening. I'm very well aware, dear listeners, by the way, that you probably want to get at him. I don't mean in a negative way, but ask him a question or make a comment. But I want to make sure that we get through all six. And if we get through number five, I will then open the lines and take a couple of questions. I'll do it now. All right. So, dear listeners, if you have an initiative that you would like to gain traction, ideally go viral or not even necessarily, it could be just within your workplace, but you would like to describe an idea that you feel is important. And ideally, it would be something that is really important, not just important selling another, you know, tool and die kit or whatever, but something that feels important. And you would like Jonah Berger's idea about how he would go and try to build support for it, virality for it. The phone number here at Work with Marty Namco, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And before I even finished giving out the phone number, the lines are light up. So let's go to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Namco and Jonah Berger. What is your question for him?
Hello?
Hi, it's you.
Oh, okay. I didn't know. If you wanted to get more people to wash their hands after using the bathroom before exiting the bathroom, what would you do?
So I think one key question there is, do we have any idea that other people are doing it? I actually think a lot of people probably do wash their hands every time they're in the bathroom, but we have no idea. It's a little bit like organ donation. Think about when they ask, at least in Pennsylvania, they put a sticker on your ID if you're an organ donor, but I have no idea whether my friends are organ donors because it's so private. So you need something to make it more public. Imagine if in the bathroom, for example, it was really easy to see whether others are washing their hands rather than difficult.
Exactly.
Imagine that every time you washed your hands, you went outside and you made a mark on the board, right, to record, yes, I did or I did not. Or there was a light on in the bathroom every time someone turned outside the bathroom, every time someone turned on the faucet to wash their hands so that someone could see, just like when we're in an airline, we can see if someone's in the bathroom, you can see whether the person used their washed their hands or not. If the light went on outside the bathroom every time someone washed their hands, we'd be sure to wash our hands because we'd want everyone else to know that we did. And so I think one key there is to make the private public, making it easier to see what people are doing.
And, you know, I've got another idea. This one I stole from Bob Cialdini, the author of Influence, who's also a key member of Obama's messaging team. He invokes social pressure this way. He would put a sign up in the bathroom that says, 85% of people wash their hands before leaving the bathroom, thereby improving the health for everybody in the workplace. So you would feel like you're one of the 15% of losers if you don't do that. What do you think of that, Jonah?
I think that's a good idea, and that's exactly, and Cialdini has done some nice work on this idea of social proof and making the private public, about making it easier to see what others are doing. I think the one problem there, messaging does help, but we believe it even more when we see someone else doing it, mm-hmm. rather than just hearing about some number of people are doing it. But numbers are definitely helpful. We have to be careful, though. So actually, a few years ago, anti-drug ads, the idea was to use this cleverly, right? The idea was we're going to want to tell kids to stop using drugs. So
So we'll say, hey, you know, someone's going to ask you if you should use drugs. You need to be ready to say no. But research actually found that anti-drug ads might have increased drug use, might have increased the number of people that try drugs. Why? Well, because at the same time they're telling people don't use drugs, drugs are bad, they're also telling people that other people are using drugs. Hey, you know, other kids in school, they're going to tell you not to use drugs, and you need to be able to say no. And you're a kid, you're sitting there going, I didn't know drugs existed, and the coolest kids are doing them in school. Who would have thought?
Right.
And so by telling you that other people are doing something, it's going to make you more likely to do it.
It's also raising consciousness. You know, a lot of kids never even thought about drugs, and then they go and they see these don't do drugs. Oh, there's this thing called drugs. Even if without the social proof thing. Oh, yeah, it is. It just, it reminds them of the existence of it. Anyway,
yeah,
okay.
It makes it more top of mind.
Yeah, top of mind, exactly. I want to thank you for the call. Our lines are all lighted up. Let's go right back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Jonah Berger, the author of Contagious. What's your question for him? It's you.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm well. What's on your mind?
I work with veterans out here in a small rural community.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the biggest challenges we have is reaching out to our fellow veterans, especially younger folks. And I'm just looking for a way to create consciousness among the organizations. I work for a county organization, and be able to promote it to the, you know, get them, get other organizations, get their staff to get the word out to veterans in this method that you're describing.
Jonah?
That's a great question, and causes are a key part of the book. Nonprofits are a key part of the book. The first thing I would say is actually, if you go to my website, it's jonahberger.com. There's a free workbook there that you can apply.
Let me spell it, by the way. Jonah is J-O-N-A-H, and Berger is not like hamburger. It's Berger, B-E-R-G-E-R, the more common approach to spelling it. Please continue.
Thanks. And if you go to the resources tab, there's a bunch of free resources there. One is a workbook. It can help you work through these concepts and apply them to any service, any product, any nonprofit. But I think about, as you said, you have a specific audience you're going after. You want veterans in particular. And what you can do is you can take advantage of the fact that people tend to be friends with similar others. So people who like football, well, they tend to have friends that like football. People who are into environmental causes tend to know other people that are into environmental causes. The same with veterans. And so if you can find some veterans, it's likely that they know other veterans. And so you can use that to help your message snowball in that community. This actually happened to me a few years ago. Publishers often send academics books, hoping we'll assign them in our classes. But they didn't just send me one copy of a book. They actually sent me two copies of the same book. And you could say, well, why would they send me two copies? The second one's not going to be any better than the first one. But they sent along a little note that said, hey, Professor Berger, we think you'll like this book. Check it out. And by the way, we think you'll know someone else who liked this book, and please pass it on to them as well. And so using your existing fan base, your existing followers, your existing users as a way to help the message diffuse is really key, because they're going to know other veterans. Veterans tend to stick together. They tend to be parts of communities. They tend to have meetings and events with other veterans, and that can allow you to get your message out. It's almost like a searchlight that goes through a social network to find the right person for a message. No one's going to tell someone about baby clothes if they don't have a baby. No one's going to talk to someone about veteran support services who's not a veteran.
Yep.
But they will take that message and they'll find the right person.
A corollary for that is that any small business that has a mailing list, the best source of new customers is your old customers. There is a commonality among them. So by pitching to them, you're more likely to get that word of mouth and virality than if you go to some new population. Anyway, I hope that helps. I want to take one more call. Back to the phones. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. Jonah Berger, author of Contagious. What's your question for him?
Hi.
Hi.
My name is Reed in San Francisco.
Hi, Reed.
Am I? Okay, I'm connected. This is kind of a two-pronged question. One part is aimed at the professor. The other part is aimed at Marty. I wonder if he could analyze the success of Facebook using his categories. And the aspect of the question that's aimed at Marty is, a couple of weeks ago, you offered a critique of Facebook, which, unfortunately, I missed because somebody came to the door. Could you repeat that?
Well, let's start with Jonah. What's your take? Obviously, Facebook is just, it's a medium. It's like a pen or a word processing program. It's not a good or bad vehicle in itself. It's how it's used. What are your thoughts about Facebook as a tool for creating virality?
There's a couple important things here to remember about Facebook. So first, Facebook is great. It's definitely changed the way we communicate. There's actually built-in social currency there. We love feeling special, so we always want to go on and see if there's a new message for us to look at or someone contacted us. But actually, if you look at the data, only 7% of word of mouth is online.
Mm-hmm.
Not 70, mm-hmm. not 17,
mm-hmm. right.
7%.
Right.
And by online, I mean things like Facebook, things like Twitter, but also things like blogs. Yes, we do spend some time online, but we spend a lot more time offline. And so in all this hype around social media mm-hmm. is great. It's a useful tool for your product or business or idea. It can be a very useful tool. But don't ignore offline word of mouth, because there's so much more conversations, whether it's around the breakfast table and having lunch with colleagues at work, friends having coming over for dinner. All these face-to-face conversations makes up a huge percent of what we talk about and share. And so don't forget those. Don't forget those one-to-one conversations that we have face-to-face and how we can make our messages part of those conversations.
Yeah, part of my critique of Facebook is that as we know unconsciously, our Facebook friends, our LinkedIn connections, our Twitter followers are not really our close friends. We tend to trust, when we make buying decisions, we trust our real friends, not our Facebook friends so much. So yes, because it's free and easy to disseminate broadly to a large number of people on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, and Pinterest, and whatever, and Instagram, we can do that easily. But in terms of, these are like very distant ties. So one of my real for not trying to be, I'm not a big fan of Facebook as a tool for other than fun, is because the quality of the connections is bad. It's also a huge time suck. The opportunity cost of using is bad. But there's something that is more close to the ground. Of all the people that I interact with, I have noticed that Facebook is following what appears to be the model that MySpace did 7 years ago. It was hot. Everything is hot for a while. And there is always a need for the next best thing. And MySpace for a while, everybody had to be on MySpace. Everybody was involved in MySpace. And it faded because it was replaced by Facebook. I am seeing on the ground that more and more people say, I've been there, done that with Facebook. I also have a lot of connections in the venture capital and advertising communities, and the corporate spends on Facebook are down because they're not seeing the ROI. They're not seeing the return on investment with Facebook and the social media marketing thing. It's becoming a passe thing, but it's like cigars. It's not dead yet. Look at the stock price of Facebook. It opened at 33. It's now 25. It's not zero, but it's, remember that the stock price is an index of the collective wisdom of the world and a forward-looking index. So it means the collective wisdom of the world projecting forward is not bullish on what Facebook is. And that is the essence of my argument for why I think Facebook is going to be like the cigar stores of the 80s. They were hot for a while and are going to fade. It's going to be replaced by some. Hey, Jonah, by the way, thank you for the call. Jonah, do you have any thoughts as to whether Facebook will evolve or be replaced as a major tool for not just for fun, but for building virality?
I think the question is, and Facebook is great, and so is Twitter, and there are all these technologies. But in some cases, we get so enamored by the technologies that we forget to think about the psychology. Right? So 5 years ago, MySpace was really big. It seemed like a hit, and lots of people spent time and energy figuring out a MySpace strategy. Foursquare was supposed to be the next mm-hmm. big thing, mm-hmm. and then it wasn't. Mm-hmm. Now Pinterest is becoming mm-hmm. bigger. All these technologies are fine, but by focusing so much on the technologies, we forget to understand why do people use them in the first place? Why do people share some things on these technologies rather than others? Getting on Facebook, getting on Twitter with your business, with your idea, that's not a strategy. You need to understand not only how to get on it, but how to use it effectively. If you're on it, but no one's sharing your messages, it's not going to be very useful. If you're on Twitter and you're tweeting five times a day or once a day, it's about getting your message to spread, getting people to pass it on, getting them to retweet it, and getting them to share it. And so to do that, we need to understand the psychology of talk, the underlying human behavior that drives us to pass things on. And that's what Contagious does, right? The book builds on the existing psychology we understand and distills it into some key principles that people can apply to get their own ideas to catch on.
We've got about 4.5 minutes left. I want to make sure we get through the last two principles. I am talking with Jonah Berger, the author of a book, Contagious, which distills a decade of research on what makes ideas and products go word of mouth, viral, and just simply catch on. The fifth of your principles for effective messaging is something you call practical value. But practical value, that seems pretty obvious. Everything needs to have practical value. What's not not obvious about the notion of practical value as key to effective messaging.
Let me give you one example, and in 4.5 minutes, I think we're going to have a tough time getting through both last two letters of the framework, but I'll give you one example for practical value.
Right.
So one part of what I talk about in the practical value chapter is deals. Obviously, deals are one thing that people love, that they share.
Right.
That's one reason Groupon has done so well.
And dying
find
now.
Yourself, if you ever find yourself driving, you know, you get a Groupon for something that's an hour from your house, and it's a restaurant you don't even like, that type of cuisine, you know, Kazakhstani food. I've never even tried it, but there was such a great Groupon, I had to get it. That's the seduction of deals. That's why we get pulled in. But what makes a deal seem good? Mm-hmm. And so one thing I talk about in the book is what I call the rule of 100. Which is basically the following. You can frame a deal as either a percentage off or an amount of money off. So a $20 t-shirt, you can say, well, it's $5 off, it'd be $15, or you can say it's 25% off, still $15. Now, that deal, both of those are the same amount of money, but what research shows is that deal seems better if it's 25% off mm-hmm. than $5 off.
Mm-hmm.
The same deal, the same amount of money, seems better when it's framed one way rather than the other.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might think, okay, well, that means percentage deals are always better, but that's actually not the case. If you go above $100, that's mm-hmm. why it's called the rule of 100, it flips. Mm-hmm. So take a $2,000 laptop, take 25% off that, would be $1,500, or $500 off, both also $1,500. The same deal seems better there when it's $500 off rather than 25% off. And so it's about how you frame that deal, how you manipulate or shape the same information, how you frame that information to make it seem smaller or larger. You can do the same thing with quantities as well. If you have a movement and you want to represent that as many people have showed up, it's about how you represent those numbers or present them in a way to make them seem larger or smaller. And so one thing I talk about in practical value is how you can frame information to make it seem more impactful.
Okay. And the sixth of your factors is stories. I mean, everyone knows that the average Joe is convinced more by a story than by data. But other than by incorporating the previous principles you've talked about in your telling a story, is there anything else that's key to making a story effective in creating behavior or attitude change?
It's not just a story, because you can create a great story, but unless your detail, your brand, your message, your idea, your movement is part of that story, and you've just created a great story that's going to travel on without carrying you with it. You want a story that's going to carry you, a Trojan horse story, a story that's going to pull your message along for the ride like a vessel that your brand, your benefit, your movement is hidden inside. Will It Blend is a great example of this. We talked about it again. It's not just engaging content. People learn the benefit that they want you to understand. Many great messages are like this. Google, for example, people love to talk about Google. One thing they talk about is the food at Google. Oh, they have all this great food, and it's really amazing, and they have this, like how they use behavioral economics and psychology to figure out which food to feature and how to organize it. It's a great story, but along the way, they're talking about Google. They're not just sharing content. Google is an integral detail to that story. So it's not just about storytelling. It's about creating a Trojan horse story, a story that carries your message, your brand, your benefit along for the ride.
Well, Jonah Berger, you have had a Trojan horse. Embedded in your book, Contagious, is a very interesting, smart guy, Jonah Berger. nice tie-in there as well. And I thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemko. The book is Contagious. It is a fun read and yet a substantive read, not just shooting from the hip. I do commend it to you. And I do appreciate you giving me part of your Sunday, Jonah, especially the full hour. Good deal. Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Marty. Appreciate it.
Pleasure. That is Work with Marty Nemko for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Sunday at 11. I will do 3-minute workovers on callers. And you're maybe far from a kid anymore, and yet you're still not sure what you want to be when you grow up. My wife, Dr. Barbara Nemko, and I are going to discuss careers in the second half of life. Until next Sunday, this is Marty Nemko reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.